She imagined a hand, a huge green hand, suddenly slamming its way up through those clouds and seizing the 767 the way an angry child might seize a toy. She imagined the hand squeezing, saw the jet fuel exploding in orange licks of flame between the huge knuckles, and closed her eyes for a moment. "Don't go down there," she wanted to scream. "Oh, please, don't go down there." But what choice had they? What choice? "I'm very scared," Bethany Sims said in a blurred, watery voice. She moved to one of the seats in the center section, fastened her lap belt, and pressed her hands tightly against her middle. "I think I'm going to pass out." Craig Toomey glanced at her, and then began ripping a fresh strip from the route map. After a moment, Albert unbuckled his seatbelt, got up, and sat down beside Bethany and buckled up again. As soon as he had, she grasped his hands. Her skin was as cold as marble. "It's going to be all right," he said, striving to sound tough and unafraid, striving to sound like the fastest Hebrew west of the Mississippi. Instead, he only sounded like Albert Costner, a 17-year-old violin student who felt on the verge of pissing his pants. "I hope," she began, and then Flight 29 began to bounce. Bethany screamed. "What's wrong?" Dinah asked Laurel in a thin, anxious voice. "Is something wrong with the plane? Are we going to crash?" "I don't..." Brian's voice came over the speakers. "This is ordinary light turbulence, folks," he said. "Please be calm. We're apt to hit some heavier bumps when we go into the clouds. Most of you have been through this before, so just settle down." Rip. Don Gaffney looked toward the man in the crew neck jersey again and felt a sudden, almost overmastering urge to rip the flight magazine out of the weird son of a bitch's hands and begin whacking him with it. The clouds were very close now. Robert Jenkins could see the 767's black shape rushing across the white surfaces just below the plane. Shortly, the plane would kiss its own shadow and disappear. He had never had a premonition in his life, but one came to him now, one which was sure and complete.
"When we break through those clouds, we are going to see something no human being has ever seen before. It will be something which is utterly beyond belief, yet we will be forced to believe it. We will have no choice."
His hands curled into tight knobs on the arms of his seat. A drop of sweat ran into one eye. Instead of raising a hand to wipe the eye clear, Jenkins tried to blink the sting away. His hands felt nailed to the arms of the seat.
"Is it going to be all right?"
Dinah asked frantically. Her hands were locked over Laurel's. They were small, but they squeezed with almost painful force.
"Is it really going to be all right?"
Laurel looked out the window. Now the 767 was skimming the tops of the clouds, and the first cotton candy wisps drifted past her window. The plane ran through another series of jolts, and she had to close her throat against a moan. For the first time in her life, she felt physically ill with terror.
"I hope so, honey," she said. "I hope so, but I really don't know."
"What's on your radar, Brian?" Nick asked. "Anything unusual? Anything at all?"
"No," Brian said. "It says the world is down there, and that's all it says. We're..."
"Wait," Nick said.
His voice had a tight, strangled sound, as if his throat had closed down to a bare pinhole.
"Climb back up. Let's think this over. Wait for the clouds to break. Not enough time and not enough fuel."
Brian's eyes were locked on his instruments. The plane began to bounce again. He made the corrections automatically.
"Hang on. We're going in."
He pushed the wheel forward. The altimeter needle began to move more swiftly beneath its glass circle. And Flight 29 slid into the clouds. For a moment, its tail protruded, cutting through the fluffy surface like the fin of a shark. A moment later, that was also gone, and the sky was empty, as if no plane had ever been there at all. The main cabin went from bright sunlight to the gloom of late twilight, and the plane began to buck harder. After one particularly hard washboard bump, Albert felt a pressure against his right shoulder. He looked around and saw Bethany's head lying there, as heavy as a ripe October pumpkin. The girl had fainted. The plane leaped again, and there was a heavy thud in first class. This time it was Dinah who shrieked, and Gaffney let out a yell.
"What's that? For God's sake, what was that?"
"The drinks trolley," Bob Jenkins said in a low, dry voice. He tried to speak louder so they would all hear him and found himself unable.
"The drinks trolley was left out, remember? I think it must have rolled across."
The plane took a dizzying roller coaster leap, came down with a jarring smack, and the drinks trolley fell over with a bang. Glass shattered. Dinah screamed again.
"It's all right," Laurel said frantically. "Don't hold me so tight, Dinah. Honey, it's okay. Please, I don't want to die. I just don't want to die."
"Normal turbulence, folks." Brian's voice, coming through the speakers, sounded calm, but Bob Jenkins thought he heard barely controlled terror in that voice. "Just be...
Another rocketing, twisting bump. Another crash as more glasses and mini bottles fell out of the overturned drinks trolley. Calm, Brian finished. From across the aisle on Don Gaffney's left. Reep. Gaffney turned in that direction.
Quit it right now, motherfucker. I'll stuff what's left of that magazine right down your throat.
Craig looked at him blandly. Try it, you old jackass. The plane bumped up and down again. Albert leaned over Bethany toward the window, her breast pressed softly against his arm as he did. And for the first time in the last 5 years, that sensation did not immediately drive everything else out of his mind. He stared out the window, desperately looking for a break in the clouds, trying to will a break in the clouds. There was nothing but shades of dark gray.
"How low is the ceiling, mate?" Nick asked. Now that they were actually in the clouds, he seemed calmer.
"I don't know," Brian said. "Lower than I'd hoped, I can tell you that. What happens if you run out of room?"
"If my instruments are off even a little, we'll go into the drink," he said flatly. "I doubt if they are, though. If I get down to 500 feet and there's still no joy, I'll take us up again and fly down to Portland."
"Maybe you ought to just head that way now," Brian shook his head. "The weather there is almost always worse than the weather here."
"What about Presque Isle? Isn't there a long-range SAC base there?"
Brian had just a moment to think that this guy really did know much more than he should.
"It's out of our reach. We'd crash in the woods."
"Then Boston is out of reach, too."
"You bet."
"This is starting to look like being a bad decision, matey."
The plane struck another invisible current of turbulence, and the 767 shivered like a dog with a bad chill. Brian heard faint screams from the main cabin even as he made the necessary corrections and wished he could tell them all that this was nothing, that the 767 could ride out turbulence 20 times this bad. The real problem was the ceiling.
"We're not struck out yet," he said. The altimeter stood at 2,200 feet.
"But we are running out of room. We..."
Brian broke off. A wave of relief rushed over him like a cooling hand.
"Here we are," he said. "Coming through."
Ahead of the 767's black nose, the clouds were rapidly thinning. For the first time since they had overflown Vermont, Brian saw a gauzy rip in the whitish-gray blanket. Through it, he saw the leaden color of the Atlantic Ocean. Into the cabin microphone, Brian said, "We've reached the ceiling, ladies and gentlemen. I expect this minor turbulence to ease off once we pass through. In a few minutes, you're going to hear a thump from below. That will be the landing gear descending and locking into place. I'm continuing our descent into the Bangor area." He clicked off and turned briefly to the man in the navigator's seat.
"Wish me luck, Nick."
"Oh, I do, matey. I do."
Laura looked out the window with her breath caught in her throat. The clouds were unraveling fast now. She saw the ocean in a series of brief winks, waves, white caps, and then a large chunk of rock poking out of the water like the fang of a dead monster. She caught a glimpse of bright orange that might have been a buoy. They passed over a small, tree-shrouded island, and by leaning and craning her neck, she could see the coast dead ahead. Thin wisps of smoky cloud obscured the view for an endless 45 seconds. When they cleared, the 767 was over land again. They passed above a field, a patch of forest, what looked like a pond.
"But where are the houses? Where are the roads and the cars and the buildings and the high-tension wires?"
Then a cry burst from her throat.
"What is it?"
Dinah nearly screamed.
"What is it, Laurel? What's wrong?"
"Nothing,"
she shouted triumphantly.
Down below, she could see a narrow road leading into a small seaside village. From up here, it looked like a toy town with tiny toy cars parked along the main street. She saw a church steeple, a town gravel pit, a little league baseball field.
"Nothing's wrong. It's all there. It's all still there."
From behind her, Robert Jenkins spoke. His voice was calm, level, and deeply dismayed.
"Madam," he said, "I'm afraid you are quite wrong."
A long white passenger jet cruised slowly above the ground 35 miles east of Bangor International Airport. 767 was printed on its tail in large, proud numerals. Along the fuselage, the words "American Pride" were written in letters which had been raked backwards to indicate speed. On both sides of the nose was the airline's trademark, a large red eagle. Its spread wings were spangled with blue stars, its talons were flexed, and its head was slightly bent. Like the airliner it decorated, the eagle appeared to be coming in for a landing. The plane printed no shadow on the ground below it as it flew toward the cluster of city ahead. There was no rain, but the morning was gray and sunless. Its belly slid open. The undercarriage dropped down and spread out. The wheels locked into place below the body of the plane and the cockpit area. American Pride Flight 29 slipped down the chute toward Bangor. It banked slightly left as it went. Captain Engel was now able to correct his course visually, and he did so.
"I see it," Nick cried. "I see the airport. My God, what a beautiful sight!"
"If you see it, you're out of your seat," Brian said. He spoke without turning around. There was no time to turn around now.
"Buckle up and shut up."
But that single long runway was a beautiful sight. Brian centered the airplane's nose on it and continued down the slide, passing through 1,000 to 800. Below him, a seemingly endless pine forest passed beneath Flight 29's wings. This finally gave way to a sprawl of buildings. Brian's restless eyes automatically recorded the usual litter of motels, gas stations, and fast food restaurants. And then they were passing over the Penobscot River and into Bangor airspace. Brian checked the board again, noted he had green lights on his flaps, and then tried the airport again, although he knew it was hopeless.
"Bangor Tower, this is Flight 29, he said. "I am declaring an emergency. Repeat, I am declaring an emergency. If you have runway traffic, get it out of my way. I'm coming in."
He glanced at the airspeed indicator just in time to see it drop below 140, the speed which theoretically committed him to landing. Below him, thinning trees gave way to a golf course. He caught a quick glimpse of a green Holiday Inn sign and then the lights which marked the end of the runway. 33 painted on it in big white numerals were rushing toward him. The lights were not red, not green. They were simply dead. No time to think about it. No time to think about what would happen to them if a Learjet or a fat little Doika puddle jumper suddenly trundled onto the runway ahead of them. No time to do anything now but land the bird. They passed over a short strip of weeds and gravel, and then concrete runway was unrolling 30 feet below the plane. They passed over the first set of white stripes, and then the skid marks, probably made by Air National Guard jets this far out, began just below them. Brian babied the 767 down toward the runway. The second set of stripes flashed just below them, and a moment later there was a light bump as the main landing gear touched down. Now Flight 29 streaked along runway 33 at 120 miles an hour, with its nose slightly up and its wings tilted at a mild angle. Brian applied full flaps and reversed the thrusters. There was another bump, even lighter than the first, as the nose came down. Then the plane was slowing, from 120 to 100, from 100 to 80, from 80 to 40, from 40 to the speed at which a man might run. It was done. They were down. "Routine landing," Brian said. "Nothing to it." Then he let out a long, shuddery breath and brought the plane to a full stop, still 400 yards from the nearest taxiway. His slim body was suddenly twisted by a flock of shivers. When he raised his hand to his face, it wiped away a great warm handful of sweat. He looked at it and uttered a weak laugh. A hand fell on his shoulder.
"You all right, Brian?"
"Yes," he said, and picked up the intercom mic again. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "welcome to Bangor." From behind him, Brian heard a chorus of cheers, and he laughed. Nick Hopewell was not laughing. He was leaning over Brian's seat and peering out through the cockpit window. Nothing moved on the gridwork of runways. Nothing moved on the taxiways. No trucks or security vehicles buzzed back and forth on the tarmac. He could see a few vehicles. He could see an Army transport plane, a C-12, parked on an outer taxiway, and a Delta 727 parked at one of the jetways. But they were still as statues.
"Thank you for the welcome, my friend," Nick said softly. "My deep appreciation stems from the fact that it appears you are the only one who is going to extend one. This place is utterly deserted."
In spite of the continued radio silence, Brian was reluctant to accept Nick's judgment. But by the time he had taxied to a point between two of the passenger terminal's jetways, he found it impossible to believe anything else. It was not just the absence of people, not just the lack of a single security car rushing out to see what was up with this unexpected 767. It was an air of utter lifelessness, as if Bangor International Airport had been deserted for 1,000 years, or 100,000. A jeep-driven baggage train with a few scattered pieces of luggage on its flatties was parked beneath one wing of the Delta jet. It was to this that Brian's eyes kept returning as he brought Flight 29 as close to the terminal as he dared and parked it. The dozen or so bags looked as ancient as artifacts exhumed from the site of some fabulous ancient city. I wonder if the guy who discovered King Tut's tomb felt the way I do now, he thought. He let the engines die and just sat there for a moment. Now there was no sound but the faint whisper of an auxiliary power unit, one of four at the rear of the plane. Brian's hand moved toward a switch marked internal power and actually touched it before drawing his hand back. Suddenly, he didn't want to shut down completely. There was no reason not to, but the voice of instinct was very strong. Besides, he thought, I don't think there's anyone around to bitch about wasting fuel, what little there is left to waste. Then he unbuckled his safety harness and got up. Now what, Brian? Nick asked. He had also risen, and Brian noticed for the first time that Nick was a good 4 inches taller than he was. He thought, I have been in charge. Ever since this weird thing happened, ever since we discovered it had happened, to be more accurate, I have been in charge. But I think that's going to change very shortly. He discovered he didn't care. Flying the 767 into the clouds had taken every ounce of courage he possessed. But he didn't expect any thanks for keeping his head and doing his job. Courage was one of the things he got paid for. He remembered a pilot telling him once, They pay us $100,000 or more a year, Brian, and they do it for just one reason. They know that in almost every pilot's career, there are 30 or 40 seconds when he might actually make a difference. They pay us not to freeze when those seconds finally come. It was all very well for your brain to tell you that you had to go down, clouds or no clouds, that there was simply no choice. Your nerve endings just went on screaming their old warning, telegraphing the old high-voltage terror of the unknown. Even Nick, whatever he was and whatever he did on the ground, had wanted to back away from the clouds when it came to the sticking point. He had needed Brian to do what needed to be done. He and all the others had needed Brian to be their guts. Now they were down, and there were no monsters beneath the clouds. Only this weird silence and one deserted luggage train sitting beneath the wing of a Delta 727. So, if you want to take over and be the captain, my nose-twisting friend, you have my blessing. I'll even let you wear my cap if you want to. But not until we're off the plane. Until you and the rest of these geese actually stand on the ground, you're my responsibility. But Nick had asked him a question, and Brian supposed he deserved an answer. Now, we get off the plane and see what's what, he said, brushing past the Englishman. Nick put a restraining hand on his shoulder. Do you think... Brian felt a flash of uncharacteristic anger. He shook loose from Nick's hand. I think we get off the plane, he said. There's no one to extend a jetway or run us out a set of stairs, so I think we use the emergency slide. After that, you think, matey. He pushed through into first class and almost fell over the drinks trolley, which lay on its side. There was a lot of broken glass and an eye-watering stink of alcohol. He stepped over it. Nick caught up with him at the rear of the first-class compartment. Brian, if I said something to offend you, I'm sorry. You did a hell of a fine job. You didn't offend me, Brian said. It's just that in the last 10 hours or so, I've had to cope with a pressure leak over the Pacific Ocean, finding out that my ex-wife died in a stupid apartment fire in Boston, and that the United States has been canceled. I'm feeling a little zonked. He walked through business class into the main cabin. For a moment, there was utter silence. They only sat there, looking at him from their white faces with dumb incomprehension. Then Albert Costner began to applaud. After a moment, Bob Jenkins joined him, and Don Gaffney and Laurel Stevenson. The bald man looked around and also began to applaud.
What is it? Dinah asked Laurel. What's happening?
It's the captain, Laurel said. She began to cry. It's the captain who brought us down safe. Then Dinah began to applaud, too. Brian stared at them, dumbfounded. Standing behind him, Nick joined in. They unbuckled their belts and stood in front of their seats, applauding him. The only three who did not join in were Bethany, who had fainted, the bearded man who was still snoring in the back row, and Craig Toomey, who panned them all with his strange lunar gaze and then began to rip a fresh strip from the airline magazine. Brian felt his face flush, This was just too goony. He raised his hands, but for a moment they went on regardless. Ladies and gentlemen, please, please, I assure you, it was a very routine landing.
Shucks, ma'am, 'twern't nothing,
Bob Jenkins said, doing a very passable Gary Cooper imitation, and Albert burst out laughing. Beside him, Bethany's eyes fluttered open, and she looked around, dazed.
We got down alive, didn't we? She said. My God, that's great. I thought we were all dead meat.
Please, Brian said. He raised his arms higher, and now he felt weirdly like Richard Nixon, accepting his party's nomination for 4 more years. He had to struggle against sudden shrieks of laughter. He couldn't do that. The passengers wouldn't understand. They wanted a hero, and he was elected. He might as well accept the position and use it. He still had to get them off the plane, after all. If I could have your attention, please. They stopped applauding one by one and looked at him expectantly, all except Craig, who threw his magazine aside in a sudden, resolute gesture. He unbuckled his seatbelt, rose, and stepped out into the aisle, kicking a drift of paper strips aside. He began to rummage around in the compartment above his seat, frowning with concentration as he did so. You've looked out the windows, so you know as much as I do, Brian said. Most of the passengers and all the crew on this flight disappeared while we were asleep. That's crazy enough, but just that other people must be around somewhere. We survived whatever it was, so others must have survived it as well. Bob Jenkins, the mystery writer, whispered something under his breath. Albert heard him, but could not make out the words. He half-turned in Jenkins' direction just as the writer muttered the two words again. This time, Albert caught them. They were false logic.
The best way to deal with this, I think, is to take things one step at a time. Step one is exiting the plane.
I bought a ticket to Boston, Craig Toomey said in a calm, rational voice. Boston is where I want to go. Nick stepped out from behind Brian's shoulder. Craig glanced at him and his eyes narrowed. For a moment, he looked like a bad-tempered house cat again. Nick raised one hand with the fingers curled in against his palm and scissored two of his knuckles together in a nose-pinching gesture. Craig Toomey, who had once been forced to stand with a lit match between his toes while his mother sang Happy Birthday, got the message at once. He had always been a quick study, and he could wait.
We'll have to use the emergency slide, Brian said. So I want to review the procedures with you. Listen carefully, then form a single file line and follow me to the front of the aircraft.
4 minutes later, the forward entrance of American Pride's Flight 29 swung inward. Some murmured conversation drifted out of the opening and seemed to fall immediately dead on the cool, still air. There was a hissing sound, and a large clump of orange fabric suddenly bloomed in the doorway. For a moment, it looked like a strange hybrid sunflower. It grew and took shape as it fell, its surface inflating into a plump, ribbed slide. As the foot of the slide struck the tarmac, there was a low pop, and then it just leaned there, looking like a giant orange air mattress. Brian and Nick stood at the head of the short line in the portside row of first class.
There's something wrong with the air out there, Nick said in a low voice.
What do you mean? Brian asked. He pitched his voice even lower.
Poisoned? No, at least I don't think so. But it has no smell, no taste.
You're nuts, Brian said uneasily.
No, I'm not, Nick said. This is an airport, mate, not a bloody hayfield. But can you smell oil or gas?
I can't. Brian sniffed, and there was nothing. If the air was poisoned... He didn't believe it was, but if it was a slow-acting toxin, his lungs seemed to be processing it just fine.
But Nick was right. There was no smell,
and that other, more elusive quality that the Brit had called taste, that wasn't there either. The air outside the open door tasted utterly neutral. It tasted canned.
Is something wrong? Bethany Sims asked anxiously. I mean, I'm not sure if I really want to know if there is, but...
There's nothing wrong, Brian said. He counted heads, came up with 10, and turned to Nick again. That guy in the back is still asleep. Do you think we should wake him up? Nick thought for a moment, then shook his head.
Let's not.
Haven't we got enough problems for now without having to play nursemaid to a bloke with a hangover? Brian grinned. They were his thoughts exactly. Yes, I think we do. All right. You go down first, Nick. Hold the bottom of the slide. I'll help the rest off.
Maybe you'd better go first, in case my loud-mouthed friend decides to cut up rough about the unscheduled stop again.
Brian glanced at the man in the crew neck jersey. He was standing at the rear of the line, a slim monogram briefcase in one hand, staring blankly at the ceiling. His face had all the expression of a department store dummy.
I'm not going to have any trouble with him, he said, because I don't give a crap what he does. He can go or stay. It's all the same to me.
Nick grinned. Good enough for me, too. Let the grand exodus begin. Shoes off?
Nick held up a pair of black kidskin loafers.
Okay, away you go.
Brian turned to Bethany.
Watch closely, miss. You're next.
Oh, God. I hate shit like this.
Bethany nevertheless crowded up beside Brian and watched apprehensively as Nick Hopewell addressed the slide. He jumped, raising both legs at the same time so he looked like a man doing a seat drop on a trampoline. He landed on his butt and slid to the bottom. It was neatly done. The foot of the slide barely moved. He hit the tarmac with his stocking feet, stood up, twirled around, and made a mock bow with his arms held out behind him.
Easy as pie, he called up. Next customer?
That's you, miss, Brian said.
Is it Bethany?
Yes, she said nervously. I don't think I can do this. I flunked gym all three semesters, and they finally let me take home ec again instead.
You'll do fine, Brian told her. He reflected that people used the slide with much less coaxing and a lot more enthusiasm when there was a threat they could see. A hole in the fuselage or a fire in one of the portside engines. Shoes off? Bethany's shoes, actually a pair of old pink sneakers, were off, but she tried to withdraw from the doorway and the bright orange slide just the same.
Maybe if I could just have a drink before...
Mr. Hopewell's holding the slide and you'll be fine, Brian coaxed. But he was beginning to be afraid he might have to push her. He didn't want to, but if she didn't jump soon, he would. You couldn't let them go to the end of the line until their courage returned. That was a big no-no when it came to the escape slide. If you did that, they all wanted to go to the end of the line. Go on, Bethany, Albert said suddenly. He had taken his violin case from the overhead compartment and held it tucked under one arm. I'm scared to death of that thing, and if you go, I'll have to. She looked at him surprised.
Why?
Albert's face was very red.
Because you're a girl, he said simply.
I know I'm a sexist rat, but that's it.
Bethany looked at him a moment longer, then laughed and turned to the slide. Brian had made up his mind to push her if she looked around or drew back again, but she didn't.
Boy, I wish I had some grass, she said,
and jumped.
She had seen Nick's seat drop maneuver and knew what to do, but at the last moment she lost her courage and tried to get her feet under her again.
As a result, she skidded to one side when she came down on the slide's bouncy surface. Brian was sure she was going to tumble off, but Bethany herself saw the danger and managed to roll back. She shot down the slope on her right side, one hand over her head, her blouse rucking up almost to the nape of her neck. Then Nick caught her, and she stepped off.
Oh, boy, she said breathlessly. Just like being a kid again.
Are you all right? Nick asked.
Yeah, I think I might have wet my pants a little, but I'm okay.
Nick smiled at her and turned back to the slide. Albert looked apologetically at Brian and extended the violin case.
Would you mind holding this for me? I'm afraid if I fall off the slide, it might get broken. My folks would kill me.
It's a Gretsch. Brian took it. His face was calm and serious, but he was smiling inside. Could I look? I used to play one of these about 1,000 years ago.
Sure, Albert said.
Brian's interest had a calming effect on the boy, which was exactly what he had hoped for. He unsnapped the three latches and opened the case. The violin inside was indeed a Gretsch, and not from the bottom of that prestigious line, either. Brian guessed you could buy a compact car for the amount of money this had cost. Beautiful, he said, and plucked out four quick notes along the neck. My dog has fleas. They rang sweetly and beautifully. Brian closed and latched the case again. I'll keep it safe. Promise.
Thanks.
Albert stood in the doorway, took a deep breath, then let it out again.
Geronimo,
he said in a weak little voice, and jumped. He tucked his hands into his armpits as he did so. Protecting his hands in any situation where physical damage was possible was so ingrained in him that it had become a reflex. His seat dropped onto the slide and shot neatly to the bottom.
Well done, Nick said.
Nothing to it, Ace Costner drawled, stepped off, and then nearly tripped over his own feet.
Albert, Brian called down. Catch!
He leaned out, placed the violin case on the center of the slide, and let it go. Albert caught it easily 5 feet from the bottom, tucked it under his arm, and stood back. Jenkins shut his eyes as he leaped and came down aslant on one scrawny buttock. Nick stepped nimbly to the left side of the slide and caught the rider just as he fell off, saving him a nasty tumble to the concrete.
Thank you, young man. Don't mention it, matey.
Gaffney followed, so did the bald man. Then Laurel and Dinah Bellman stood in the hatchway.
I'm scared,
Dinah said in a thin, wavery voice.
You'll be fine, honey, Brian said. You don't even have to jump.
He put his hands on Dinah's shoulders and turned her so she was facing him with her back to the slide. Give me your hands, and I'll lower you onto the slide. But Dinah put them behind her back.
Not you. I want Laurel to do it.
Brian looked at the youngish woman with the dark hair.
Would you?
Yes, she said.
If you tell me what to do.
Dinah already knows. Lower her onto the slide by her hands. When she's lying on her tummy with her feet pointed straight, she can shoot right down,